All right, well, let's begin. I want to thank everyone for coming out to this inaugural talk of the lecture series. We particularly want to thank the We want to thank the Distinguished Visitor Fund at the University of Alberta and Director of the UCO program, Sean Guglis,
and Waterboy,
Jeffrey Rockwell, for arranging the funding for this series, and the Office of Interdisciplinary Studies, the staff there, for their help in arranging the travel and the various logistics. So that's Barb Hagel and Sheila Trotman and Leona Earle, Janie Kennedy. I turn over now to Jeffrey Rockwell to introduce the speaker.
So it's almost a question of how you're going to introduce someone. One can start with the person's sort of basic coordinates. Willard McCarty is a professor of humanities computing at King's College London. He's a fractional professor at the Center for Cultural Research, the University of Western Sydney. And I assume, is it a fraction of you that is a professor, or you're only... Anyway, I think I know what that means.
I have to decide which part goes to Sydney.
Which part, yes. And he's a visiting professor at the University of Sofia in Bulgaria. But I want to talk some more about some of the things that make us terribly pleased that he agreed to come here as a distinguished visiting speaker. First of all, Willard has written probably one of the most important books in the field. His 2005 Humanities Computing is one of the first sustained reflections on the field, its disciplinarity, its methods. And this isn't a field which, by and large, has not done a lot of writing and theorizing. We tend to be a very project-oriented digital field, as you would imagine, humanities computing. So his work from 2005 really stands alone. There are very few other works of such sustained thought. Willard is also very well known as the moderator and provocateur of the discussionless humanist. Humanist was started in 1987. I'm going to read a line from the very first humanist message that he sent. Humanist, and it's all in caps, by the way, is a BitNet, NetNorth, electronic mail network for people who support computing in the humanities. Now, how many of you remember BitNet, or know what BitNet/NetNorth was, or had a BitNet/NetNorth email address? Very few of us. You win the extra pamphlet. We give you an extra there. But Humanist has been a remarkable instrument of cohesion in our field, because since 1987 we have had this one discussion list bringing us together, and this one voice. Those of you who subscribe to Humanist know that it isn't simply a sort of collection of emails that people send in. First of all, Willard moderates it. He weeds out the spam and he gathers the email messages into coherent groups. And secondly, any time there's any tapering off of interest or people wander off, he sends these long, very thoughtful and provocative messages. In some ways, he was a blogger before blogging came along, but was combining blogging and discussion. So the result has been is that Humanist has been one of the things, along with the conferences and some journals, that has really brought us together. And Willard has moderated it almost nonstop since 1987. I think there were two or three years when Elaine Brennan took over, and it just wasn't the same. And then you took back over. And this is in spite of the fact that I'm willing to bet he got no academic credit for this crucial community-building work. But very important to a bunch of us, myself especially, has been the fact that Willard has always been a supporter of new researchers and graduate students. And here's where I get to relate a few sort of personal anecdotes here. I remember very vividly, I still have an image in my head of standing at his office door where I had found out, I was at the University of Toronto, I was a graduate student, I'd found out about this strange program called the Apple Research Partnership Program, which paid in Macintoshes. And since I didn't have a lot of money, but I desperately wanted more Macintoshes, this struck me as a good thing. And I still remember being at his door and asking him about this and being encouraged to apply. In fact, I that was joining that program was part of my sort of introduction to humanities computing. I also remember the courses he ran in the early 90s. He ran what were some of the first graduate courses in humanities computing. And in fact, I recently, digging through some boxes, found the two-sheet handout from the version of the course that I took, and I've actually given it to one of our graduate students. We're going to scan it in and put it in. we're going to circulate it. But this course, in many ways, was a precursor both to the program that we have here, but more importantly, I believe, was a precursor to the Princeton-Rutgers Summer Seminar, which in turn set a model for summer seminars like the DHSI at the University of Victoria. That course, even though it was a non-credit course, was one of the first experiments in trying to teach this as a discipline. And in so many other ways, Willard has encouraged and helped new scholars. But I'm going to close by quoting from one of his anniversary messages, because on humanist anniversary and also on the solstice, various other times of the year, he writes these interesting messages. And here's one from the 14th anniversary. We're 14 years old now, a venerable age in this medium, like everything else, somewhere between coming into being and going out of it, like the swift flight of a single sparrow, and here he's quoting from the venerable Bede, through the banqueting hall where you are sitting at dinner on a winter's day with your thens and counselors. In the midst, there is a comforting fire to the warm hall, to warm the hall. Outside, the storms of winter rain or snow are raging. The sparrow flies swiftly in through one door of the hall and out through another. While he is inside, he is safe from the winter storms, but after a few moments of comfort, he vanishes from sight into the wintry world from which he came. And I'd like to welcome you to our warm halls. If you're lucky, it'll get really cold outside. And I have this feeling that you're sort of flying in. We'll have you for a while, and then fly out to the wintry world from which you came. So thank you very much for coming so far to speak to us.
I have only one correction in that very generous introduction to make, and that is that I never got any particular academic credit from doing humanist. In fact, humanist is the reason I have my only academic job so far, my first and last academic job probably. Although I'm sure the panel of people who interviewed me at King's College London in 1996, after 12 years following my PhD of me wandering around in the academic demimonde, they would say that they hired me because of some project I was working on, I suppose. But I wouldn't have been at that interview had it not been for humanist. And I think there's a good object lesson in that. Namely, it was the one thing I did that I never expected to be rewarded for, and that had no academic credit and no particular standing in the academy. Yet it is what has given me the most consistent benefit and the most substantial benefit in all sorts of ways. I can't promise that if you give away your time, you will be rewarded, unfortunately, but I certainly have been. This is the first in a series of five lectures whose overall topic is the history of computing and literary studies during its incunabular period from the beginning in 1949 till the onset of the web in 1991. Because this is a public lecture, it is meant both to stand on its own and to summarize what follows. I'm going to give you a brief summary of what all five lectures will be about, which doesn't release you from this terrible moral obligation of coming to all five, but at least it'll give you a warning of what you're in for. But first I want to give you some idea of why I do what I do and why you might be interested in it. Today we take computing more or less for granted. For most of us, in fact, computing is ubiquitous and utterly commonplace, though sometimes frustrating and clearly imperfect. So it is difficult for us to imagine the explosive sense of excitement, the seeing of visions and the dreaming of dreams among those who were thinking about building and using computers in those early days. By the 1950s, researchers worldwide were tackling problems relevant to the humanities with their mainframes. By 1950, they were doing that. In 1962, the Times Literary Supplement devoted a series of articles to computing, later published as a book entitled Freeing the Mind. In that series, the Cambridge linguist Margaret Masterman, to whom I will refer many times in the following hours of these lectures, wrote expansively about possibilities for a telescope of the mind that would do for us, for our understanding of literature, what optical instruments had done once for cosmology. When in 1966 Joseph Rabin founded the journal Computers and the Humanities, activities in all or nearly all of the disciplines were well underway. But by then, researchers had run into serious, crippling difficulties. It had become obvious to some, at least, that visions such as Masterman's were a very long way from being realized, that current ideas and methods were not going to get them there, and that mainstream scholars were simply not interested. Complaining about lack of professional recognition became endemic to the professional literature, and with the web, interest turned elsewhere, isolating the complainers even more. Complaints have nevertheless been tiresomely voiced ever since, up to last year, which is the last time I saw one of these, with a prevalent tendency to blame external forces, such as Chomskyan linguistics or French critical theory. They're the two big evil empires that people complain about. Nevertheless, many of us continue to think that more remains possible, that the problem is not inherent to computing and not located elsewhere, but lies with our ideas of computing and of text. But rather than speculate about both and fall immediately to building some new tool or other, my response is to attempt a history of literary computing. The purpose of writing this history is to bring into view not merely the facts of the case, what has and has not been done, what researchers have discovered or not, and what they have said or not. Its purpose is more to focus on the questions that these facts raise. My historian's argument is that once we can turn our givens into questions, we can then get to causes, influences, interrelations, and the wider contexts that have shaped the activity. We can then begin to understand literary computing to date as a self-determined activity rather than a more or less passive response, and so to think creatively about how it could enter into the mainstream. Why should anyone but the specialists care? I don't have time to comment on the importance of literature for a life worth living. Allow me simply to assert that it is essential to human self-understanding. What then remains for me to establish is that computing is, or could be, a fit instrument for engagement with literature. I will do this, though I will take a very broad view of what literature is. My first lecture, this one, attempts to survey and summarize the whole, to recover, if not Masterman's imaginative vision, then the impetus to envision what could be, to bring into view the critical situation computing might address, to provide examples of problems we might work on, and to give some indications of the rewards we might enjoy. The second lecture, on the profits of anxiety and failure, critics and computers, surveys the crippling troubles that surrounded the application of computing to the study of literature during its incunabular period. The curious reactions of practitioners to computing and what we might learn from those practitioners. The third lecture, Emergent Theory, Writing a Recent History for the Present, explains what sort of history I think I am writing, or more accurately, attempting to figure out how to write, a Foucauldian history of the present about something that is very recent. The fourth lecture, Excitement Elsewhere, Cybernetics and Complementarity, turns attention to the creative ferment with which was central to computing in the early years, and asks why it did not reach the digitally adept literary scholars of the time. The fifth and final lecture, The Future, What's Going On, considers where we are and, with a somewhat better idea of where we have been, in what directions we might now go. Before I get started with all that, however, I owe you a serious warning. At the outset, I thought this was a project that could be done in a year. I now doubt that it can be done in 10, but I'm giving it 3. I accepted the kind invitation to give these lectures not to tell you what you don't already know. I don't yet know enough to do such telling, but to enlist the cooperation of an intelligent audience in thinking through some quite preliminary arguments, testing their strength, and raising questions I have somehow unaccountably overlooked. Wittgenstein's concluding proposition from the Tractatus rings in my ears. Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. What you cannot speak about, you must pass over in silence. But there will be for me and for you time enough for silence, I think. So accepting the risks to be taken, I think it better to speak anyhow, providing you understand that what is spoken is a conversational offering intended to draw attention to my topic and to provoke debate, if not superior efforts. My term Piscocyte is borrowed from Thomas Fuller's mid-17th century treatise, Episcocyte of Palestine, which in turn refers to Moses' vision of the Promised Land from Mount Pisgah in Deuteronomy 34. I allude to this story not just because it is an archetypal visionary experience, but also because this experience is set into the great sinusoidal pattern of biblical history, from depths to heights and back again, but with a progressive refiguration of the promise. In other words, the vision is different yet related each time, recurrent yet cumulative, simultaneously eternal and historical. If we think in this way, which is, after all, culturally our way, about computing, then what the early visionaries and enthusiasts saw, we also can see, but in a new form, under new circumstances. What they feared is likewise both identical and different from what spooks us, or should be spooking us. Hence, from time to time, I will direct a steady gaze to the dark side, to our passive surrender as end users of whatever we're given to reason with and believe in, whether it be PC, Macs, or Linux. In fact, the fact in consequence of our profession's imaginative failure to engage with computing as end maker, that more than 60 years after it all began, we are still disappointingly at sea. That more generally, quote, we so willingly sleepwalk through the process of reconstituting the conditions of human existence, as Langdon Winner has said. While I think that such statements are worth heeding, I am exceedingly wary of making the dark case they imply. I am wary because I wish to avoid entrapment within the paranoid style of thought which such a case would entail. In his famous article, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, historian Richard Hofstadter conjectured that the disposition to see the world in this way may be a persistent psychic phenomenon, mostly dormant, but mobilized into prominence by particular historical threats or frustrations. That's published in 1964. Computing has since its beginnings posed just such a threat to our idea of ourselves, as I will explain here, and to which I will return in the following lectures. Matching the hype with which we have been subjected are, move for move, accounts in the paranoid style, some of them silly, but some quite well argued, even brilliant in their way. The problem is that, like the intelligent paranoid's vision, they make altogether too much sense of everything. The story they tell is too perfect. Their historiography is deeply flawed because their narrative element is too strong. I'm not going to promote computing in the humanities as the dawn of a new heaven and a new earth, nor condemn it as the end of life and culture as we have known them, but attempt to look beyond what we currently understand computing to be. This means seeing it as foreground against an imaginative background of multiplying possibilities, which in turn means valuing it for the shortcomings and failures which point to something better. Here, with an eye to the future, I am not interested in the usefulness of current products, such as the Valley of the Shadow, the Blake Archive, or the prosopography of the Byzantine world, fine though they are, and important as it is to pay attention to them. These constitute the digital humanities in my sense, that is, the applications of computing in the disciplines for their own individual purposes. Rather, I am interested in the transdisciplinary research questions which such products raise by failing completely to satisfy. critical, intelligent dissatisfaction with them points the way to further and better work in the disciplines. So far, so good. But the thread I spoke of is real and must be heard to resonate with the dissatisfaction I am recommending. Allow me to speak to it quickly before getting on to the substance of this lecture. In very rough, highly simplified terms, we know that the digital computer came as a kind of byproduct from a mathematical proof by Alan Turing in 1936. To make this proof, he invented an abstract scheme, the so-called Turing machine, which he used to define the meaning of the term computable. At the time, this meant able to be computed by a human being, which is why in his 1936 article, he based his machine on the operations of a perfectly obedient mathematical bureaucrat sitting in his desk doing sums. Sometime later, given a particular emphasis in the work of Herbert Simon, Alan Newell, and others, computing came to be understood as manipulating symbols rather than just calculating numbers. Hence, in turn, computable came to mean exactly specifiable. And so an exact statement meant one which a computing machine can process. In consequence, we get a perfectly circular argument. Whatever can be exactly stated can be done by a machine that defines what an exact statement is. As a result, in the words of the cognitive psychologist George Miller, recalling the early days of computing, quote, computer programs begin to look like the language in which you should formulate your theory, end quote. To those within this hall of mirrors, disciplines such as those of the humanities, within which stating theories as programs is not even remotely possible, look very dubious indeed. But the problem does not stop there. As Catherine Hales comments in How We Became Posthuman, equating precision with computation means that the residue of the uniquely human becomes coextensive with the linguistic qualities that interfere with precise specification. The uniqueness of human behavior thus becomes assimilated to the ineffability of language. Therefore, to be human is to be imprecise, ambiguous, unclear, muddled. This isn't a new thought, of course. The story of the Tower of Babel, Plato's myth of the cave, and St. Paul's enigmatic mirror are early formulations. Most of us feel this way about ourselves most of the time, and if we don't, we should. What is new is the definition, or rather useful parody, of unclouded vision and ungarbled speech. Thus, the automaton as a disturbingly ever closer parody of ourselves, raising again and again the question of who and what we are. Or to put the matter the other way around, escape from the closed world is marked by those signs of failure and led by dissatisfaction with the parody. Thus, George Miller continues, "The farther I go with theorizing in software, the more limitations I see. It isn't so much a matter of finding that mathematics is wrong, or that computer programs are wrong. None of them seem adequate to say what I've got to say. But my further point is that we're not just dealing here with some annoyance that progress in technology will solve. The inadequacies Miller came upon, and the inadequacies we come upon daily in our analytical work with machines, are the intimations of a new Pisgah. This leaves us incomplete, uncertain, anxious, all forms of the yearning for wholeness that Plato's Aristophanes describes in the Symposium. It's desire's way of speaking. Fear's way would be to echo the philosophical neurophysiologist Warren McCulloch's confession of his greatest dread. When we run to catch a baseball, he wrote, we run not toward it, but toward the place where it will be when we get there to grab it. This requires prediction. The earmark of every predictive circuit is that if it has operated long uniformly, it will persist in activity or overshoot. Otherwise, it could not project regularities from the known past onto the unknown future. That is what, as a scientist, I dread most. For as our memories become stored, we become creatures of our yesterdays, mere has-beens in a changing world. This leaves no room for learning. As a human being, I confess that what matters to me far more than professing what I know is learning what I don't. Though rightly pursued, these two things become but differing ways of talking about the same form of life. For me, the most wonderful form of life there is. Let me illustrate now where we are by considering a few texts and one or two other things. In doing this, I will attempt to indicate the complexity of the problems they raise, describe what we now know how to do with them, the benefits which we know even current techniques bring, and vague sightings of what might lie beyond. I will ask you not to pause at the current state of the art, but to awaken your desire and let it reach forward toward the ever-receding horizon of possibilities, to what might be done by someone, somewhere, someday, perhaps here. In other words, my objective is to sketch a mode of imagining rather than to describe anything imagined, built, and delivered. I am concerned not with what we demonstrably know how to do, rather with what we don't but want. My first example is from the book Am Wegesrand, by the side of the road, the work of two German-American graphic artists, Fritz Kredel, who did the woodcuts of flowers, grasses, leaves, and roots, most of which he found in Inwood Park, not far from his home in New York City, and Georg Salter, who wrote out the poems. Am Wegesrand was published in Frankfurt in two forms, a limited hand-colored edition in 150 signed copies printed at the Bauersche Gießerei, from which this image was taken, and an uncolored trade edition without the calligraphy printed by Der Goldene Brunnen. Today, we could put together online what is loosely called a digital edition of Am Wegesrand with superb high-definition images of each page, or better, each opening, transcriptions of the poetry, commentary, links to the scholarship on it, biographies of Kredel and Salter, examples of their work with links to dedicated online sites, and so forth and so on. By judicious use of markup, we could render it computationally tractable and so produce it for online or printed distribution in any describable form. Doing this would engage our best technical experts, and it would raise questions not merely of technique, but also of relevance. It would lead us to look quite closely at the original, looking at it even in a new light, ask how it does what it does, and so reconsider exactly what we thought we were doing. It would lead us to some very large and difficult questions. For example, what genre we are groping toward, or as it is more usually asked, what we might mean by a digital edition, to which currently we have no good answer, and what relationship to computing might be implicit in our relationship to the work of art, how the one might model or even simulate the other. Please remember those questions. I'll get back to them. What we now have a considerable experience doing this sort of thing for a wide variety of manuscripts, archival collections, and printed books from all periods. Despite clever bells and whistles, most of the benefit comes from the straightforward access to images and transcriptions, which, as I say, is important, but it is not the whole story. To illustrate, allow me to move from the 20th century codex to a medieval gloss manuscript, say Leiden 87, from the 9th century, written in Carolingian minuscule. There can be no question of substituting digital images for the physical manuscript, however fine the imaging, although good images are of enormous help and worth all our efforts to provide. The physical presence of the codex affords an experience rich in information and significance to the scholar, for which no simulacrum we know or can imagine how to build serves adequately. Rather, the question is, what more than high-definition imaging can computing do to supplement direct physical study? What, in other words, can we imagine the digital manuscript edition to be? To answer that, we must ask, among other things, about the dynamics and semiotics of a 9th century reading, about what mediating devices might be constructed to model and so test our ideas about that reading, what tools might be made available, for example, to analyze the dynamics of letter formation, the so-called ductus literarum, so as partially at least to automate the identification of hands, while looking ever more closely into how this is done, and so on, as long as we take an interest in such objects. This is, as we say, knowledge engineering. But in common with the best work in artificial intelligence, the scholarly point for the maker of such tools is the residue of questions left over from the making. The scholarly question for the doer is, what can we not do? Manuscripts are well protected, sometimes too well protected. Take the BNF in Paris, for example. Epigraphic objects, which may be simply stones in a field somewhere, are often not protected at all from weather, thieves, warfare, opportunistic builders, and so on. Here, for example, thanks to my London colleague Charlotte Roucher, is a column with a rare instance of a painted inscription next to the discarded water bottle, which has somehow survived, lying out in the site at Ephesus and gradually deteriorating. One can understand from such examples how an epigraphy, with its prominent reporting function, creating a digital resource, taps into motivations that for the scholar go deeper than plummets sound. The digital medium answers irresistibly to old dreams and against old fears. This answering is undoubtedly good, very close to a perfect marriage between what can be done and what we know to want. I do not wish in any way to gainsay it. But for interpreters like me, and for the future of the digital humanities, what counts is the questioning. The future dawns when the answers and solutions we have show in their inadequacies, by breaking down, proving insufficient, or just by being too comfortably predictable, and so harbingers of the has-been life, as McCulloch said. Those inadequacies, if pressed, defamiliarize both the tool and the object to which it is applied. In Jerome Bruner's paraphrase of Viktor Shlovsky's, the Russian formalist Viktor Shlovsky, what was obvious and familiar is then made strange so that we look at it afresh with a beginner's mind. Now for something completely different. Even, you may think, so Pythonesque as not to belong in a formal lecture at all. Text that is found in public places, such as signs, pavements, gutters, walls, rubbish bins, posh airport shops, t-shirts, anywhere at all. Linguists who have already noticed this chaotic goldmine of linguistic data call it public textuality, and they have, of course, theories about it. I'm going to talk about it here, however, in its more specific form as text that, as a rule, is experienced in the moment, often only for a moment, in passing, and is collected at best, as best one can, with a digital camera. Then the image is uploaded with significant words identified to the online Dictionary of Words in the Wild, invented by my old friend and Alberta professor, Jeffrey Rockwell. I freely confess that I have chosen public textuality. Oh, I know you, I owe you another image. Yes, there's the dictionary. Recent. I freely confess that I have chosen public textuality in part for its shock value, to loosen your mental grip on the object of study so that we may consider the instrument's mediating characteristics and potential. As for my current example, two questions are worth asking. First, about the scholarly interest in such a demotic toy, how that could possibly have any interest for scholars. Second, the value the specifically digital arts and humanities might derive from it. The first question is the easier. In essence, it is answered by arguing that there is nothing which the scholar cannot find significant, providing he or she asks the right questions. For the dictionary, these questions largely belong not so much to the humanities as we have known them, rather to what the distinguished Australian Ian Ung has called the applied humanities, that is, scholarship meant to have a direct impact on the lives of ordinary people by engaging them critically with cultural artifacts, not only very ordinary, to speak with Raymond Williams, but also fundamentally practical and pervasive to social life, as it is inherent to how the world is made to mean, and therefore how the world is run. These applied humanities are an invigorating blend, if you will, with the socially engaged social sciences. Ung argues that the applied humanities thus gives a wider public a much better appreciation of, and so willingness to support, the humanities as a whole, and in turn they, like computing, give to the traditional humanities stimulating new forms of old problems. One new form of the problem I have just considered and to which I will return is the nature and dynamics of reading. It informs the question more specifically relevant to the social domain of the applied humanities, namely, what the public textuality of a place says to those who live there, and even more to the point, how a critical awareness of the ambient text empowers them to do better with what they have or not. My response to the second question about the value of the dictionary project to digital practice begins similarly by noting that formally, procedurally, methodologically public textuality of the 21st century, even of the 21st century working class East London neighborhood where I live, is no less challenging or rewarding than Pompeian graffiti or formally incised text on a Roman monument, for example. Both involve relating the interpretation of verbal meaning to the aesthetic, physical, and social contexts. How could we investigate this relation by means of computing, which would require, in the first instance at least, that we have a mechanism for recalling images by some combination of lexis and graphesis? Here I suspect that outside the perimeter of the CIA, no one has any idea of how to design such tools as would be required to answer these questions. Or perhaps they have designed them and I just don't know about them. So is there any point to the dictionary and all the work that has gone into collecting its images? I was uploading images to the dictionary before I came here this evening. By providing means for capturing and storing these images where they may be seen, commented on, and studied, camera and website enable an eye-opening to words as we mostly encounter them. Experience suggests that ordinarily we register very little of what passes before our eyes, noticing text-bearing matter, if at all, as a blur of advertising, signage, rubbish, and the like. But dismissing this blur as mere noise becomes very rapidly more difficult the more you look for and at public text, and the more you credit how language is materialized in time and space, even if its manifestations are as accidental and rubbishy as we are. These images tell obliquely, fleetingly, ironically, the whole human story. But how do they tell it exactly? That is the question. When told deliberately, they constitute a kind of demotic myth-making. When the accidental rules, how are these images read? What is then the text? A question over which more ink has been spilt in textual and editorial theorizing over the last few decades than perhaps any other. How indeed do we regard accident in a world that we now know to be fundamentally probabilistic, as Ian Hacking and Robert Laughlin and others have argued? These are anything but silly questions, anything but irrelevant to criticism, say of literature, in a Bakhtinian world of others' words. I said that the technical challenge posed is in much part the same as any collection of images one wishes to study. But since the photographic recording and subsequent editing reach toward a perceptual moment, Henri Cartier-Bresson's Kairos of what was seen, not what was factually or is it fictionally out there to be seen, we are also challenged to re-examine and where we can to adapt inherited techniques of photography and to automate other interventions such as location tracking. We are challenged better to understand, first by introspection, then by automation, how we see in the fleeting moment, what we carry away from it, how daily life is made in the moment with words. Yes, this is to some extent a half-made tool looking for an ill-defined job. It is something done out of curiosity for what might be made of it. If that bothers you, I ask that you ask yourself why, but keep the answer on hold to the end, because I'll return to it. Now I turn to proper literature. I summon, for an example, a single poem, Seamus Heaney's Field of Vision, which I intend to stand for all written text we regard as literature. I have chosen a very recent poem so as to minimize the importance of textual history, although that is not unimportant. I have chosen something in English so as to get all of us here as immediately close to the experience of reading as possible. I have chosen Heaney because I love his poetry. I remember this woman who sat for years in a wheelchair, looking straight ahead out the window at sycamore trees unleafing and leafing at the far end of the lane. Straight out past the TV in the corner, the stunted, agitated hawthorn bush, the same small calves with their backs to wind and rain, the same acre of ragwort, the same mountain. She was steadfast as the big window itself. Her brow was clear as the chrome bits of the chair. She never lamented once, and she never carried a spare ounce of emotional weight. Face to face with her was an education of the sort you got across a well-braced gate, one of those lean, clean, iron roadside ones between two whitewashed pillars, where you could see deeper into the country than you expected and discovered that the field behind the hedge grew more distinctly strange as you kept standing, focused and drawn in by what barred the way. Let that poem do what it is doing in your mind while I discuss literary computing for a bit. I'll get back to it at length in the lectures to follow. But meanwhile, allow the difference between it and the evident activities in literary computing that I am about to sketch serve as an implicit, ironical commentary. That commentary will teach us as much humility as we are capable of learning. Once it seemed as if written text were the low-hanging fruit of the digital harvest. From the end of the 1940s, when philologist Father Roberto Busa began his great Index Thomisticus project to produce a concordance to all St. Thomas's writings, until the coming of the web in the early 1990s, much of the work in literary computing was of this kind. But as I said earlier, already by the early to mid-1960s, the fruit reachable from the ground was beginning to seem less than adequate for literary critical purposes. Some scholars at the time could see the problem, a turning away from adventurous, imaginative, but risky work to do what could easily be done and would pass as useful without comment. In my next lecture, I will return to this problem in much greater detail and pay close attention to the nature of the risk practitioners saw and to the language they used in identifying it. A particular interest will be the mixture of desire and fear betrayed by this language, if not straightforwardly declared, and to the construction of the computer as slave or servant. Why people should think of computing in terms of the master-servant dialectic is far too complex for me to unpick here. Suffice it to say, with gross oversimplification for the moment, that they did think thus because it seemed easily to sort the fundamental challenge computing posed and poses to who and what we think we are. Computing is, of course, not alone in this challenge. As we know, refiguring what it means to be human is an ongoing and deeply disturbing project. But when, to get straight to my point, we consider the interpretive practice of literary criticism, if, as now is becoming possible, we start thinking about bringing the computer close to the human, under the skin of scholarship, not as a servant to it, but as an intimate, we are perforce asking the question of the human and the question of text and the question of what happens when these two intermingle in reading. Where are we now? We have crafted artfully online literary resources of great value to our colleagues. We have simple but elegant techniques to interactive concording for the day when close reading is a gain of interest. Best of all, we have come to the point of being able to show in particular cases, but argue persuasively overall, that as John Burroughs says, work by different authors, work in different genres, work of different eras, work in different national forms of English, can all comprise statistically distinguishable groups. This means that we can get to at least some of what happens when we read before we know that we have read, or that we have read anything at all. It means that, like populations and like physical matter, we now know literature to work probabilistically. Words and things are much closer kin than once we thought they were. In his plenary address to the International Digital Humanities Conference in Toronto in 1989, Northrop Frye said quietly that when he wrote Anatomy of Criticism, such conceptions as software programming and computer modeling were as yet unknown. And if I were writing such an introduction today, he said, I should probably pay a good deal of attention to them. It took me a long time to understand the implications of that statement, the process toward which he was pointing. Not merely to the analytic modeling that demonstrates the inadequacy of any formulation we might make, and so highlights the dark residue of the uncomputable, but an abductive modeling toward suspected or merely felt but unknown patterning. I quote Fry because he saw, however uncertainly, exactly where literary computing can take us when it is liberated from servitude and we from mastery. For good historical reasons, we have inherited the notion that computing happens inside a box, sometime after we have done something on a keyboard with a mouse or other input device, and from which issues, for example on screen, the output for us to consider before the next input action. Now, if time did not matter, this would be a relevant account as well as an accurate one. But time does matter, because we are beings in time, where being in time requires a Heideggerian violence to squeeze from those three words the participial sense of being. If our computing machinery is to augment the human intellect, as Douglas Engelbart, inventor of the mouse, said it should, then it has to operate at the speed of being, as fast and intimately as corporeal thought. In the early days of such work, when in World War II the anti-aircraft problem was at the top of the scientific agenda, the bottleneck seemed to be the slow human component, or as the cyberneticists of the time called it, the machine in the middle. But now we know that the problem is to attune the machinery to us humans. Enough of our adult reaching down to accommodate the child machine. It's now time to make the child machine reach up to us. We have developmental evolutionary arguments from the likes of Merlin Donald about the role of equipment in the origins of the modern mind. We have strong analogies from the sciences to suggest that in the immediately responsive situation with computing, emergent capabilities will show themselves. And more to the literary point, we have Jerome McGann's thrilling, wild gathering of theoretical raw material from which a language might be constructed with which to talk about these emergent capabilities soberly enough to design for them. The dream, my candidate for the next Pisgah site, and I think also Jerry McGann's, is this: not only to use Heidegger's term for computing ready to hand, but more to use Michael Polanyi's, it is to have a computing from which to attend to the text in reading, not merely in the sense of a perfect e-book reader, but in a sense now barely conceivable. Take, for example, Heaney's poem, which I promised to come back to, in particular his summoning of a whole culture in the figure of the woman who never carried a spare ounce of emotional weight, of the education to powerful strangeness drawing him in. The question now to ask is, what is happening as we read these lines? What are we doing and the poem becoming? Can we do more with computing to serve that moment than so far we have done? If it is to annotate, then how might annotation be reimagined from centuries of practice to augment critical thought? Could we go out, as Fry imagined, into the whole of literature better than now, to locate Heaney's poem in this Bakhtinian world of others' words and others' experiences? Not to push a button and wait for the answer, not to follow links, not mine some million-book motherload of textual data by means of grids or clouds of computing, not work within a system of tags established canonically for us by an expert or a committee or a consensus of the great and the good, but on the spur of the moment, try things out and see what happens. Try things out and model our way toward better knowing. Do I know what I'm talking about? No, I don't. But I know that we must talk in this way toward that end. Let me rephrase by returning to Cradle's graphic art, this time for reasons of simplicity to an uncolored plate from the trade edition, the one I can actually afford. Let me say again, as at the beginning, that here stands the whole problem, which begins for me, an embodied being, with a little more than 6.5 decades of kinesthesis to his credit, in muscle-twitching, vertiginous wonder, and proceeds through a participation in the thing to a resonant understanding of that marvelous woodcut. In a work of art, the Polish-Jewish artist and writer Bruno Schulz said in 1935, the umbilical cord linking it with the totality of our concerns has not yet been severed. The blood of the mystery still circulates. The ends of the blood vessels vanish into the surrounding night and return from it full of dark fluid. The work operates at a premoral depth, at a point where value is still in statu nascendi. If art were merely to confirm what had already been established elsewhere, it would be superfluous. The role of art is to be a probe sunk into the nameless. Here, in Cradle's woodcut, Schultz's nameless is brought into view, inviting sympathetic kinesthesis by that large sweeping arc of leaf, those other twisting arcs, the whole balance of the composition, its biological dynamics. We can, as I said, photograph it, but that is only visually, to paraphrase. We can tag and catalog it, but that only helps us find it again, and so restates the problem. How can we learn it, get into it with this marvelous machine as naturally, though differently, as we learn with the Codex? Also a machine to think with, as the British literary critic Ivor Richards said of the Codex in 1925. Citing Moses on Pisgah, I made no comparison, but implicitly set one up to be made. I've seen a cartoon that people hear in which they made the connection before I even said it. The lectern is either a place of vision or a useless piece of furniture. And because, in a heavily qualified sense, knowledge does progress, and our technologies certainly do, I end with a question about the future. At this moment, as programs in the digital humanities are being crafted, even here, how best can we see to it that they yield value for all the effort and resources spent on them? Given my age and the youth of my field, you might envision me in the image of a melancholic frontiersman of an intellectual old West, watching the territories being settled, the streets paved, laws passed, and every other damn thing, as Wild Bill Hickok said in the television drama Deadwood. The truth of that metaphor is that my training, like that of others in senior positions of humanities computing, was sui generis, largely autodidactic, highly unorthodox, fortuitous, and very much against the grain. So much so that ever since I turned aside from the well-trodden path of my Dr. Vater in the mid-1980s, I have been looking over my shoulder, expecting at any moment to see the disciplinary police running after me, shouting, "Stop that man!" It is true that a dozen years spent in the academic demimonde on the wrong side of the Canadian tenure tracks bestowed freedom to explore, a survivalist strength, an artful dodger's agility, and the quality of stubbornness. But so much of the good that has happened to me is either accidental or due to others that even the unenviable part of the story is no pattern for replication, no template for the sustainable development of my field. So where from here? My kind has lived through the ignorant hostility of colleagues to the point where thoughtless familiarity with computing, and so equation with the problem solving, is as much, if not more, of a problem. Now the tendency is to domesticate computing as a handy appliance, a knowledge jukebox, as I call it, and so to conceal the very thing that should be at the center of our attention. As long as we think of the fruits of our labors as deliverables, we sustain the servitude that has all along been the sign of our sclerotic resistance to the change going on all around us and to us. It is only perhaps because the history of computing is too recent for our best minds to figure out how to write it, and is so clogged with hype that we all do not see how fundamental computing is to our time intellectually and culturally, how well connected it is to streams and rivulets of our history in the sciences, the humanities, and the arts, going very wide and way back. Please note that I do not speak on an historical intimation of some pinnacle of human achievement where we now stand, not of computing as cause of our present condition, but of a much bigger and more subtle cultural force. The two-cultured gulf institutionalized in our educational systems keeps us from seeing that computing belongs to the arts and humanities because it is of us. And recognize that connection forces us all to rethink what we are. We are now told, and it is true, that in the humanities we need to articulate for ourselves as scholars an urgent social purpose. Does not computing's involvement in our struggle with the nature of the human give us that purpose? For computing, now ambient and ubiquitous, by nature acts on the world and intervenes in our lives, changing them and changing it as it goes. Once upon a time, a computer stopped dead as soon as the operator stopped instructing it. But already by the mid-1960s, machines began to appear which found other things to do while the operator was idle. We now design and build semi-autonomous purposive agents. Autonomy is not far off. Or if it is, we are nevertheless told that it isn't by experts who believe what they say, and that is perhaps more important than their predictions. Once upon a time, computers were huge, slow, expensive, complicated, rebarbative, and in the hands of the few. Now they are small, fast, cheap, simple to operate, friendly, and everywhere, in our backpacks, on our wrists, in our household appliances. The master-slave dialectic, predicated on an unquestionable separation of human and disturbingly human-like machine, belongs to that former time. Now, in the future, to Blade Runner's present, in cinema 28 years ago, in fiction 42, it might seem that the idea to grasp is the resonance of life in corpore with a lifelike in silico. Here depicted by a brilliant icon of the human-machine mirroring that possesses our time. But there is so much more than this comfortably disturbing, cozy arrangement with our brainchild. I refer to that which we have marginalized in order to think like this. The philosopher Vernon Pratt pointed out in 1987 that we project our machines toward a concept of mind which more than meets them halfway. We construe mentality as if it involved manipulating representations of the world, then we exclaim over the success of a machine we have built to do just that. What we must try to imagine, he wrote, are alternatives to the concept of mentality which sets our agenda today, but which belongs to a framework of ideas that will surely, like all its predecessors, pass. We must, he declared, take a fresh look at the picture, partially in light of those things that the machine becomes able to do for us, and then change our ideas about which aspects of thinking or mentality are truly important. That is, about what thinking is, what text is, what music is, what drawing, sculpture, and painting are, and so to what we are. These are our questions. Exploring them is what the humanities and computing come together to do. It is what together they are for. It is an invitation to which, I hope, you will say an enthusiastic yes. Thank you very much. Comments, corrections, objections.
I have a question.
Yes, Jeff.
This is actually just something that zipped by too quickly for me. So at some point you talked about a dream that you share with Jerome Gamm. And then you alluded to Heidegger, and I heard Ready to Hand. And I'm wondering if you could just reiterate that.
I was playing with the phenomenology of tool use, as you probably recognize from the Heideggerian term. But I find much more useful Michael Polanyi, the chemist and philosopher Michael Polanyi's notion that when we use a tool, when we're using the tool, when we're, let's say, carving wood with a chisel, and things are going well, we are attending from the tool to the wood that it is affecting. Or as my calligraphy teacher used to say, our minds are at the edge of the pen. If your mind is not at the edge of the pen or at the edge of the chisel, then forget it. You're not gonna do a very good job. It's always too late by the time you see the mistake. So that process of attending through the tool, and then as Heidegger and Polanyi both emphasize, if something goes wrong, if you hit a nail which you fail to take out of the piece of wood before you start carving it, and the chisel chips or something goes wrong, then you start attending to the tool. And you recalculate, you refigure, you regrind the chisel, and then you get back to work again.
And it's that relationship with computer, through the computer, attending from the computer to a literary text. Somewhere, Stefan Sinclair pointed out, and Julia Flanders also, that one of the big problems with all our textual tools is that they take us too far away from the text we're studying. That a quick concordance takes us very far away from the text. The database takes us even further away from the text. So that it is impossible to do that simultaneous, have it establish that resonance between the computer and the material it's studying. Is that answering your question?
Well, I guess, I'm not familiar with Blondie, but I think Heidegger would say that, well, computers are like any other tools. They are, when I'm word processing, they're ready to hand. And they're functioning as part of a totality of tools. I type an email, I hit send, I fire it off. There's no circumspection. I'm not worrying about whether it's working. I'm just worrying about what I'm saying on this email. So I thought I heard you suggesting that this was a dream of something that doesn't happen now.
With a specific focus on the interpretive act of literary criticism, it doesn't happen. So, that's my argument.
But you put up the slide. I want to say, you put up that slide. I was reading Seamus Heaney's poem. It worked. The tool, I was paying attention to the poem. I wasn't sitting there going, oh, the PowerPoint broke down, this laptop's not working, the lights aren't on.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's no circumspection.
Don't you think that we could do so much better with a computer than just to project an image of the poem, which is actually a rather blurry image and doesn't give you the weight of the book in your hands, and in several other ways is rather poverty-stricken medium. But in the actual interpretative act, the computer's projecting this image of the poem, you're reading the poem, but there's no real use of the computer there once the image is projected.
So your dream is not to have the tools that work at all, but tools that work better.
Yeah, and yeah.
I guess, I'm not sure what Heidegger would say, but I'm fairly sure what Plato would say, which is, you're fooling yourself. If you want wisdom, no improvement of the tool. This tool called writing, it doesn't make us any wiser. All it is a recipe for forgetting. The dream of the better tool is never going to get you to the promised land. Which is the Pisgah view.
And Moses never gets to the promised land. Neither does Joshua. Neither does anybody since got to the promised land. But the getting there more effectively, better, with more of your resources intact, more quickly. This is the dream of progress married to the traditional humanities. Can't we do it better than we do now, for example, with a concordance tool, or with a statistical analysis package? Can't we go beyond McGann's Ivanhoe? What is the next step after Ivanhoe? And neither McGann nor Drucker have an answer to that yet.
Would you be comfortable with differently rather than better? I guess I'm bothered by the idea that there is, that there is going to be some sort of progress, that improvements of tools will, let me put it another way, the only way we could measure better would be in some instrumental way, which is not the point. It's going to be better towards some end, and that's not, I don't think that's type, I don't think an end is the sort of thing that you're actually talking about. But I can't imagine differently. And I can't imagine in the circumspection of difference that is an end in itself.
Differently, yes, but I think better also makes sense because we're dealing with a medium that does it actually improve. That we can certainly, although we don't know how to do it, we can dream of doing it, and we can make that dream rather plausible, that it will be better when less time elapses between running the program and making the interpretation from the results, that the back and forth could be speeded up to a point at which new things begin to happen because less is lost in the process. And this has always been going on with all tools. It's always been going on with computing, the rhythm between running a program, getting some results, then looking at them and going to the work of literature, let's say it's a work of literature that you're interpreting, and looking at it and then changing your mind about the software and going back and tinkering with the software. That cycle has always been going on as long as we've been dealing with computers and literature. But it has gotten better the faster the machines are, the more capacious the memory is, the more accessible the text is, the better the software techniques are. That process actually improves. And I think there is an argument, I don't know how you would measure it, mind you, other than people liking it more. Word processing has certainly improved, so there are moments when I don't think about Microsoft Word, thank God, I think about what I'm writing, that were not possible when I was using WordStar on Osborne. I think that the problem is that trying to come to terms with progress in the context of the humanities. Don't you think that's a problem?
I think that's been a problem since Plato. I don't think there's any evidence that any technology has actually made us wiser. All arguments around betterness are as the French sort of, the society of technology. All arguments of betterness are always in terms of efficiency. But efficiency is always is about doing things faster or whatever like that. But it is arguments of efficiency never give you the final end. Why you want something more efficient to begin with? In fact, if you only start thinking when it breaks down, which I think is your negativa argument in the modeling.
Yeah.
The more efficient it gets, the less you think, and the more you just write email.
Well, I can't face down Plato, and the wisdom card is something that just defeats me completely.
It's an ineffable argument. Right? How do you?
But I think that there may be some answer in what appears to be the fact that that the phenomena we're talking about are not along a smooth continuum. But that you get to certain points of efficiency or speed or interactivity or whatever you want to call it, and new things start to happen that could never happen before and you couldn't have predicted. This is the whole idea of emergent phenomena. And that's what I'm talking about, is when the interaction with the computer gets to the point, folk wisdom says that it's a second and a half. I don't know if the psychologists have done any better in actually measuring it. But there is a certain point, people argue, at which the interaction is fast enough that you cease censoring the questions you're asking. And I think that's very significant. If I have to walk 20 minutes to a library in the snow, across patches of ice, to get a book, I'm going to be very certain I want to read that book before I go. If I can just, go to my directory on my hard disk and fetch it, I will look in it, even if I have an inkling of it might be reasonable to look at. And so the frequency, the argument is that the frequency with which we are surprised increases dramatically once you get, stop that self-censoring. You may not get wiser, but you probably will do better scholarship as a result. You'll be more surprised. You burst out of your pre-existing ideas and receive wisdom more often. But wiser, if it was wisdom I was after, I would not be doing what I'm doing. I would have gone to that Zen monastery when I was 20.
Harvey. I have a question about reading. Because it seems that reading is really argument, and in some ways, the computer becomes either an obstacle or a tool that we can use to read better in some way, and maybe not necessarily more efficiently, but somehow better. And we talked a lot about even a kind of a spatial relationship to the text. Certain tools take us further away from the text. Some tools bring us closer to the text. And you made a comment almost in passing about maybe one day we'll have the research and some close reading. And then, when we get the Seamus Heaney poem, we're almost left to our own devices. And then you said, well, let the poem do whatever it will do in your mind while I continue to talk. So I wonder if you could just theorize reading again for a moment and make it, does that need to be a kind of an explicit part of the project of reconfiguring how computers affect the humanities?
Does reading need to be an explicit part?
Yeah, insofar as do we need, how, maybe the question is, how extensively do we need to theorize reading in order to move forward with computer humanities? I mean, is it the case that close reading is really the thing that we've lost and that we need to get back to? Or, on the other end of the continuum, can we give people texts and then kind of let them do with them as they will?
Well, we can always do that. By reading, I meant what scholars do when they read and interpret text, and the thoughts that they have and how they explore them. And that, I think, could be done better than we know how to do it now with the computer, in a way that would, something like what the New Critics did when close reading with a capital C and a capital R. I was also using close reading as in reading closely, as in paying attention to what you're reading, as much attention as you have to give. When texts are what English departments study, which I gather is not what English departments do now. I'm not quite sure what they do. They apparently don't do that. When the actual attention to texts is at the center of the discipline, again, as I think it's bound to be someday, that we have a lot of, we have a lot to work with by theorizing what happens when we read what we are trying to notice and how we're noticing. It's a field of open questions. We have this marvelous tool that we can make do all sorts of stuff. And we have this marvelous field of questions that arise when we talk about what happens when you read. And the mysteries become deeper the more we probe. So the more that the questions become more and more interesting. And what Burroughs has discovered makes reading a very, very interesting process. He just alone what he has discovered about the statistical patterning of closed class words, mostly closed class words. Is that beginning to respond?
Yeah, it is. And I think it's because I'm thinking my own way through those sets of questions in a number of ways. Just to take two more, one is the slide that we have right here, which is a multivocal text as well. So it's your own apology that the talk was long, but it's also...
It's a humorous apology, because I'm not really...
Because you're not really a good also, and like a good apology. And it's also, I'm presuming, a billboard for an ad.
Well, it was. You see, I was walking back in the hardware store along Lake High Road, which is right out near where I live, and it's a rubbishy high road, so it's all kinds of chaotic, visual chaos. And this happens all the time with the dictionary words in the lot of my collecting. I saw Sorry It Took So Long, and I was about to give my inaugural lecture at King's, which I gave in February. And it was 2-3 weeks away. And I thought, oh, yes. And then I noticed it was an advert. So I particularly framed it to exclude the punchline, the thing which it was advertising. I forget what it was. Because I was attempting, by using primitive photographic techniques, i.e. cropping, to actually signify, to actually pick out what I saw in the moment in which I saw it. And none of the rest of it. It's not a factual reconstruction of an advert, which is what it is. That's not exactly true either, because all the reflections here, which you can't see very well, there's a double-decker bus, and there's some old 19th century buildings in the background and stuff, reflected off the glass. That the semiotics of reflection are also busily playing a role there. And that's not what I saw, I don't think.
Yeah, so even that particular text, that's why I'm thinking about this asked it about electronic text as well. Then we can create concordances and all of these annotations, we can create all of these hyperlinks, but at the end of the day, the question is, well, what do we mean by such a thing? And so it's that relationship, I think, between readers and texts that, that I'm curious about. And so I was wondering, that's why I asked the question, and I'll probably keep asking the question in a variety of guises, which is, how do we theorize that, that thing about reading when we put computers into the mix?
I have a book, several books on my desk that I need to read. And one of them is a book on reading by a psychologist who is concerned with what happens before we know that we've read something, what the processing is, a very complex processing. That's one way of exploring it is from a psychologist's point of view. Another is to, I suppose, to observe what you do when you read, to put a part of your mind as observer of what you yourself are doing, then try to get to that processing and ask what can be used of this is of any significance to either an understanding of what reading is or what we could do as scholars to try to unpick our observations about texts and see where they come from and so be able to weigh them a bit better than we can. I mean, I don't really know. It's just a question. It's a question that keeps nagging at me about what could... There's so much going on while I read and so many things I notice and discard and connections I make and so on and so forth. And, you know, how can that be explored is my question. But it has to be a dynamical process. I mean, if you remember New Criticism, I remember being trained by a New Critic and making notes in the text and collapsing in frustration because there was no technology to record all the things that I was observing such that later I could do something with those observations. The tensions and the, you know, all of the stuff that I used to go on and on about. My copy of Paradise Lost, I used a very sharp drafting pencil, triple knot drafting pencil, which I would sharpen with a draftsman's pencil sharpener. It's a very precision little device, you know, made by some German company. Get a very fine point and make tiny little notes all over this text of Paradise Lost. It's a gloss of hardened area of Paradise Lost, little pages stuck in there. What counted at the time was the act of doing it. That's what was important. Because God knows I could never use any of that stuff again. I couldn't read it mostly, and now I don't even know why I made some of the notes that I made. And I think we can do better. I think progress does come into being wiser as a critic, perhaps not wiser as a human being, but wiser as a critic, by being able to manipulate those things. I mean, tagging has done a lot of that work for us. But then the problem with tagging is changing it afterwards. That's a big problem, which points to, you know, some new understanding of how to report those observations, and then we can do something with them afterwards. They don't just become a marvelous memorial to our years spent.
Right. Not a bad thing in its own right.
No, I pull it out every once in a while, show people it.
I kind of love Jeffrey's kind of cynicism. Picture technology about you know, trying to ask what ancient Greek scholars would think of what we're doing now as a point of criticism, which I'm now going to call sophistry as a new form of criticism. But I love this idea of sort of a semantic interpretive tagging system that would change on the fly either through kind of communal tagging or expert tagging, but also an artificial intelligence tagging. That would allow us to kind of get back to close readings of a text and allow us to sort of interrogate it in a sort of full prospect sort of way, always having the text in front of us but not being too far away from it as in a database form. Mm. And I don't think I'm anywhere near skeptical that that's that far away. I don't think we're decades from that.
No, I don't think so either.
Is it going to actually help even if we do get that, though?
Well, I don't know. I mean, so much of this, as in AI, which you referred to, so much of it is let's see how far we can get and what the world looks like when we get there.
Right.
It's very experimental. It's not theoretical in the sense that we have this theory and then we march toward the theory or we, you know, slog at it until we prove it or disprove it or whatever, falsify it.
And I think that's a refreshing way to look at it rather than in a teleological sort of way that no matter what we do, it's going to be bigger better than what we've done before. It's more of a sort of experimental way that we're going to get, hopefully.
Yes, you're right. You're right. It's much more appealing, the experimentalist vision. I mean, you have to have some hope that you know, while you're laboring up the hill, there is a top of the hill to get to and not just another false summit, that there is something driving you, some vision that's driving you that finally gets materialized in some kind of result which is stable enough that you can then go on from there.
Well, to continue the metaphor, even a false hill will help us see further. And to pick a tool that's, I think, made us wiser, the telescope, I think, finds, always helped us see further. Whether that's wisdom, I don't know, but I think it's unbound us from a lot of false premises.
It's knowledge, which is at least
partially
cumulative.
I think Sean's point of saying communal tagging gets to the core of access, which trumps my dear Jeffrey's dismissive idea of efficiency. It's not just making things more efficient, it's such profoundly better access to things for such a larger group of people that you can have an immeasurably greater synthesis of knowledge. So I think it's not just having efficient tools, it's having broader access. And it's interesting to hear some of the rhetoric of lone scholarship and people trudging up hills by themselves, and really that's less and less necessary and less and moral. And
I don't agree at all. I don't buy the either or, that we have to become collaborative, you know, that the old lone scholar is his broken back shuffling off the stage barely able to crawl, but confident, strident.
Well, but having access
new
to
collaborative human being is
having access to what these lone scholars have done. So that's a measure of useful too. The other thing I was going to point out is so many of the text tools, for example, you explained very articulately what you left out of your picture, which we couldn't have divined necessarily without your telling us that you left out what the slogan was before. Somebody could have theorized that the slogan underneath, sorry it took so long, was they were selling widgets or timers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just to catalog everything that's not in your picture wouldn't have led us there. The same way Haney left a whole bunch of words out of his poem. Like there's the OED minus the 200 words that he put in his poem.
Mm.
And we can't divine how he chose to do that just by, you know, just if we had a very robust computer that told us all the words that aren't in there. And there, well, our work is done. That's a kind of shallow efficiency that many text mining tools seem to do with a great sense of ta-da, and it doesn't. So that doesn't create wisdom or enhance knowledge. So that's, I guess, I'm agreeing with you as well.
Access is such a simple thing, and yet it changes so much. The default condition of scholarship is now, for example, JSTOR. That's where some of my students start. Go type in a few keywords and then this really dumb search that every computer scientist in the world probably will complain about. It's just string search. And precision is terrible. Recall is great, but precision is terrible. But all of a sudden, this whole interdisciplinary cornucopia opens up. And you see your problem popping up in fields all over the map. That's where people begin now. They don't begin by going, well, where's the English literature section of the library? Where's the shelf with all the Milton books? And then sort of camp there and stay there. But have this access to, it's disturbing what misuse of other disciplinary materials that's going on because of it. But it changes all everything we think about and how we think it.
And more people thinking about it, which I would argue, people who wouldn't have noticed, wouldn't have had the skills or the access to find it before. So I would say that more human ingenuity has access to it. I would say that would exist at a greater clip.
It means that we have to respond as teachers. It means we have to respond as teachers by training students how to handle this flood of new stuff. You know, what happens when you find an article in theoretical biology on a topic you thought was in English literature? What do you do? Let's say you can understand the article in theoretical biology, or you think you can. It has no equations and no difficult vocabulary. What are you then going to do? How do you benefit from it, or do you not bother? There are skills attached to that which students are not being taught, which they need to be taught. And we need to figure out what those skills are first. And that's just merely from access, from speedy access via JSTOR and Project Views and all the rest. And because we're mortal beings in time, it means let's say you have the skill to know how to handle all this interdisciplinary material, which is a big assumption, but if you assume it, and then you think, how are you going to spend your time? You're not going to spend your time so much burrowing down anymore as going wide. So a new idea of what makes for good scholarship has to comprehend that which doesn't burrow down, but which spreads out in all directions. We call it, intellectual butterfly, the behavior of an intellectual butterfly, but you can be an intellectual butterfly, I would suppose, in a good way. And I think we have to figure out what that is.
Your students are behaving in a way that we librarians complain about as much as computer scientists. Meditation to choose the right source and search it the right way. And they discover types of things to Google and find all this stuff. But they're doing what you talked about, of surprising themselves more often by doing it. They're going to find more stuff that stretches them in more directions. And it takes them into the realm of play before they get down to any work. As you were talking, I was thinking about my habits and the temptation to play when you want to be working, when you're doing this stuff, and how easy it is to play, and often how useful it is to play before you start to work, and how hard it is to draw the line when you cross from playing to working, and how badly we design games, at least in the library, when we think we have an insight into this, and we actually try to make a game that is just pathetic. Which is why I like Stan stuff so much, because it's fun to play with the game computer. So this whole element of play, I guess you didn't explicitly touch on it. Is that part of how you see the problem?
It's part of how I want to see the problem. I don't understand enough about what's going on with games applied to scholarship in order to really to say anything about it. But I know it's important. I just don't know how. I observe myself doing it, like you, playing around and searching for stuff. Then I observe a sensory mechanism engaged by years of bitter experience of what happens when I spend too much time playing. Take over and then cut myself off or put things aside to be explored later, and I know damn well I never will.
I think we should probably call it our time. We thank Willard once again. Let me remind everyone that the conversation continues tomorrow morning at is that correct? 11 o'clock in the Senate chamber.
Is it 11?
At 11. Yep. Oh.